You're listening to Good Timing. I'm your host, Isabel Hagen. I've been thinking about my motivation behind certain things that I do and whether the drive is more fear-based or because something just seems like it'll be fulfilling or fun. And I spent most of my life playing the viola. From a very young age, I was seriously studying classical music performance. And for a while, that fulfilled me and filled in the gaps in my life that were there from limited social interactions due to social anxiety. But eventually, as I got more and more advanced in music and it became less of an escape and more just my primary thing, the fear started to set in. The inferiority complex, imposter syndrome, the worry that maybe I wasn't as good as other musicians. And that fear caused me to explore other interests. I now needed an escape from music, which became comedy. If I really think about it, the drive to pursue comedy seriously in part came from a fear that I wasn't a good enough musician. So my feelings are a little complicated around comedy because on the one hand, it really is my favorite thing in the world and I have so much fun doing it. But on the other hand, it did also stem from this very self-critical place from having this complex about music. And sometimes I wonder if eventually comedy will become the thing I want to escape from. Maybe I'll decide to be a chef and that will become my thing. And then I'll eventually develop an inferiority complex about that, and then I'll have to start something else, and the cycle continues. It's interesting to me that my tendency seems to be that the more time I spend working on a craft, the more I lose faith in my ability. Naturally, it should be the other way around. Like, if I'm doing the work, I should develop more and more confidence. But at a certain point, the confidence I get from improving plateaus, and then it can start going the opposite direction. And something that I find helps with this tendency is having structure and keeping track of the hours I spend working on something, because it kind of brings me back to reality a bit and interrupts the cycle of self-hate, because I can look at my day and say, well, I spent X amount of hours on my craft today. So I know I made an incremental improvement. And also, anytime I make a plan to work on something and I follow through on that plan, I feel great about myself because, you know, how often do we really follow through? Obviously, I can't work on stand-up right now because of the pandemic. I don't really have access to an audience to try jokes out for, so that sucks. But hopefully, you're not a stand-up and whatever your craft is, you can work on it even during the pandemic. I am practicing viola more again, which I feel lucky to have as something I can work on and be fulfilled by. And I also have this podcast, which has been such a joy to put out every week. And this week's guest is one I am particularly excited about. I talked to actor Eric Bogosian. Eric is a legend. He's a brilliant actor, author, monologuist. Is that how you say it? Monologuist, I don't know. Great human. You've seen Eric in a million things on TV, in movies. You've seen him everywhere. One of his most recent roles was in the movie Uncut Gems, where he plays Arno, and he's just incredible to watch in that. You've probably seen the movie. We talk about his experience working on that film in our conversation, so you will hear about that. I worked with Eric when he asked me to do a monologue for his project, 100 Monologues, and we shot it and he directed and it was a lot of fun, and my monologue will be out eventually, but in the meantime, go to 100monologues.com. It's all monologues written and directed by Eric, and there's some really amazing work by a lot of familiar faces, so I highly recommend checking it out, 100monologues.com. And as always, if you've been enjoying these episodes, if you've been enjoying the podcast, I always appreciate any ratings or reviews or subscriptions in Apple Podcasts. It really helps me out. So if you haven't already, open up Apple Podcasts and just hit that 5-star rating or whatever rating you want to give it. Hit something. And, you know, if you want to leave a nice little review and hit subscribe, that would be great. You're great. And we're all doing great. Okay, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Eric Bogosian.
Well, I'll tell you this, I'm not funny, so that's what we'll start.
Well, the good news is that this isn't a funny podcast, so great. Also, you are very funny. I was thinking about this because I think of you as like this serious actor, obviously. You have this reputation as this artist and you have an incredible body of work, but you're, everything you do, at least everything that you've created, maybe not every role you get, but everything you've made is humorous in certain ways. There is this humor that drives what you do. And I think humor kind of drives all art in a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's one of the sort of invisible parts of what makes things delectable is the humor in them. Like if you take a show like The Sopranos, which if it's described is just like, it's a show about the mafia, you know, and they're just constantly killing people on the show, right? But if you go back and you watch the show, they're really funny. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're doing something kind of broad. Or why is Sean Connery the best James Bond? Because he's funny. It's when it's humorless. In my case, I think it all goes back to the fifth grade, and I wrote the scariest Halloween story I could write, and I read it to the class, and they all started laughing. And I think that's kind of my story all the way along. I mean, especially around when I first started doing the solo stuff in the late 70s, I was looking to make stuff that was very intense and aggressive and kind of punk inspired, but I sort of drifted over into being funny. I mean, at first I was doing one of those routines where you're the not funny lounge act. It was called the Ricky Paul Show. And there were other people doing the same things around that time. Andy Kaufman was doing that. And Bill Murray was doing that. And just do this kind of just atrocious lounge lizard. But what happens is if you keep performing in front of people live all the time, then you eventually, it's something you can learn. And it's like comics are made, not born. The super funny person. So I don't think of myself as a comic, but I do understand that at a certain point I started to get a grip, at least in the solo work, of, oh, this is, if I just pause here and wait a second and then say the line, people are going to laugh. Sometimes I don't even know why people laugh.
Yeah, that's something I go through with stand-up, you know, listening back to my sets, and I think, okay, maybe if I just take another pause right here, that'll make the joke work. And I'm, you know, actively seeking the laugh, whereas I think, you know, in monologues, you're not always, you don't need the audience to laugh. It's sort of, let's see what happens. Let's see where they laugh. Oh, that's interesting. But if they don't laugh at that place the next night, it's not considered a failure.
Yeah, in fact, it's a good idea to stick to the character and actually have to be a little careful if you are getting a big laugh in a place, because it might skew the whole thing. It might throw it off. And that's something that Joe Bonney, in directing all of those solo sketches with me, she always was forcing me to tack in that direction, because she says, if you pander, first of all, when you're playing in front of an audience and some people are laughing, that's not always all. It's not like it's all the people. They're just the people you hear. And sometimes they can pull the whole routine deeper and deeper into something that's not as interesting. And maybe there's a bunch of people over here who aren't making any sound, who are kind of intrigued by where is he going with this? And what is this all about? Eventually, I guess I kind of started to pull it in to my writing for plays, and I am convinced that the best plays are written when the playwright knows the actors he or she is going to be working with. And then you can kind of hear them while you're writing. And that was particularly true when I wrote for Steve Zahn for Suburbia, when we did that play. I had been working with Steve since he was a student, and I could just hear him doing the, it wasn't me, it was his voice that I heard.
Right. It becomes almost like you're discovering things as you hear his voice. You're not, you don't feel like you're even making it. It's just like, okay, well, what would be the next thing? Oh, I hear that now.
Yes.
And I can relate to that in a very small level of just writing sketches for myself or writing scenes that I know I'm going to be in. So obviously it's easy. I know who the character is, and I know if I'm casting my friend as the other person, then that makes it easy. If I'm just creating these people out of thin air, that's kind of nothing.
It's where you start, but yeah, you should be really open-minded, and also performers, actors, good actors. And like, okay, I started acting in high school, and then most everybody, I mean, I was like a natural. And so everybody I was with was pretty, not really very good. And then I got to college, and then there's a lot of people who think they're good, but they're actually not any good. So it wasn't until I came to New York that I started to be interacting with actors who are really good, and eventually with people who were so good that I was kind of, I'm not going to say intimidated, I was impressed by what they were doing. Sometimes just like off the charts impressed. And when you start to understand that there's that kind of actor out there, an actor who's kind of like an author, they're bringing a whole story with them. It's in their face. It's in their body. It's in everything about them. And then you've got to listen and feel for that story, and how do I pull that story? And that's where you get the most successful linkages between an actor and a writer. And when the two can find each other and put that stuff out there together, then you see great stuff. I mean, they do this all the time where they say, you know, this movie was written and they tried to cast this guy, but then they ended up casting this guy who did this historic thing. And then you go, well, what if it had been that other guy? Oh, it would have been awful. It wouldn't have worked. I mean, you can kind of imagine it, but it wouldn't be this thing. I mean, I had sort of that experience, not to pat myself on the back, because I've done a million things that I don't think really work. But when the Safdie brothers wanted me to play this character in Uncut Gems, I wasn't even sure, you know, I mean, to me, it just seemed like a stock thing that I was supposed to be doing. But they had the sense that what I bring to it would make it really full. And it was a really satisfying experience to inhabit Arno in Uncut Gems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved that movie, and you were so amazing in that. And did they tell you at what point they like had you in mind for the role, and what part of the process you came in, or did you know?
They said that they always had me in mind, and I was being a big prick through the whole process of being invited into this project. And I wasn't like a real prick. It's just that I don't know, I was being very careful. I was being too careful. And fortunately, my wife came on board and said, gee, the way you're talking about it actually sounds really interesting. And then Natasha Lyonne got a hold of me and she said, you know, you have to do this. These guys are great. And my friend Mums, Craig Grant, he had been in one of their things. He said they were great. And then I saw Good Times. And when I saw Good Times, it was like, oh, I got to work with these guys. This is amazing what they're doing. But I'm not the best decision maker. I just take my time.
What was your hesitancy initially to take the role?
There were three things. And to be really brutally honest about it, first of all, it was a low budget. And it was pretty much a scale job, which is what pretty much all low budget movies are now. And I have this notion of myself of having a craft and I should be paid for it. So because when you get down to the level of, you know, scale, it's kind of double. It's actually equal to the hourly wage of the McDonald's or something. It's not, you know, you're putting in a lot of time. You also don't know how much time it's going to end up taking. And I always feel like the paycheck is kind of the thing that when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the director is having a meltdown and the co-star is being a dickhead, that you're saying, okay, this is what, this pays for that, right? That's just my way of looking at it. The other thing was that Adam Sandler was a complete unknown quantity to me. All I knew was he was a huge star, and I've worked with huge stars, and sometimes they're great and sometimes they can be a real pain in the neck. And again, I put that into my calculations of doing the job. As it turned out, Adam was probably the nicest and easiest person I've ever worked with ever. He was a total delight. And so that was very satisfying. Also, there was, I mean, jumping into the actual doing the job, it had a, I mean, in hindsight, it had this quality of just like everything just felt right. As soon as we started working, everything made sense. Everything fit together. It's very unusual to have those experiences. And there were other people on the show who had never done a movie before. There were people who are basically non-actors, particularly Keith, who kills me at the end, who was just amazing in it and who I had a lot of scenes with. And they just assumed that when everything goes well like this, that that's going to mean that the movie's going to be great. There's also the thing that they say when you're shooting a movie, like, oh, the rushes or the dailies look terrific. I discount all of that stuff. None of that counts for anything. Having a good time in a movie set doesn't mean anything. And the rushes and the dailies looking great doesn't mean anything. There's really only one thing that'll tell you if it's good or not, and that's at the end when it's all cut and finished. So I wasn't, at any rate, but it did have that. It just was hand in glove from the beginning. And the first scene we shot, you probably don't, I mean, when you watch the movie, of course, a lot of time passes, but the first scene we shot was me in the car chasing Adam in the SUV. And that was intense, like from right from the get. And this was what they wanted. They wanted that intensity. And for some reason, I was like in it instantly. It just felt, I'm pretty good at being angry. I am angry a lot of the time. And so I guess that was, it just, they understood that and they wanted that quality and they were happy with that. When I say they, Josh and Benny.
I think, I mean, as a someone for hire, you know, I'm a musician for hire. You're essentially an actor for hire. When you're in these roles, you really never know what you're walking into. And I totally relate to that fear of collaboration. And if I don't know who I'm working with now musically, I'm like, okay, am I going to be in some like rehearsal where the composer just like feels like we're just not getting it right. And we're there for like hours. And like, I hate being a piece of someone's creative process. Sometimes, you know, it's like really frustrating if they don't know what they want once they use me. And of course there is going to be some things that happen in the moment organically. Of course, you bring things to the table, they react, you react. But like, it seems like in this production, like they really had an idea of what they wanted and it all just sort of fit together.
Yeah, I mean, they were dealing with a lot of variables. They had actors in there who weren't, they had stars who weren't actors, Kevin Garnett. And they found things as they were working. And Lakeith is, you know, he's kind of a genius in his own right. So he comes up with stuff as they were working. And Adam was totally the way that I look at the way you should be acting in movies, which is when the camera isn't rolling, you don't have to be in character all the time. But when the camera's rolling, you just dive right in. And that's what he would do. One of the things that was I was being very wary about going in, and the reason why I was a little reluctant to even do the job was I could see that the end of the movie, I am stuck in this plexiglass cubicle thing. And I had this image in my mind of being in there with two other guys I don't know, while Adam Sandler, the star, is outside trying to figure out what his, you know, what his motivation is or something. And this goes on for days and days and days. And so what I did was I told them that if I did the job, I'm claustrophobic and I can't be in, or I had my manager tell them this, I can't be in an enclosed space for more than a certain amount of time, like more than 20 minutes at a time. And I completely forgot that I had said this. And so we got time to shoot it. And as we're getting ready to set the scene up, you know, the first AD comes up and goes, "We know that you're claustrophobic and you're only going to," and I'm like, "What? Oh, right, right, right." I'm like, "No, it's, don't worry about it now." Because by that point, I knew that Adam was cool and everybody was cool. And I was ready to swing with whatever they wanted to do. And it was wonderful. It's just such a great experience. And yeah.
So not only, I mean, you're an actor, and I think it sounds like, you know, acting when it's good, it's kind of like the best, but you've also spanned a ton of different mediums. You've written books, you've written plays, you've worked with dancers. What do you think the drive to span over different mediums comes from?
Boredom. Yeah. If I've done something, I'm looking for the next, you know, fun thing to do. Sometimes I get in over my head. I mean, the history book, Operation Nemesis, which I spent 7 years on, let's be honest, I'm not a scholar. I had never done this kind of research before in my life. I thought, I'm good friends with Sarah Vowell, who's a wonderful historian and writes popular history books. And you might know Sarah, you might not know Sarah, but Sarah is fantastic. And I kind of felt like I could write a sort of pop history book based on this assassination squad that I had learned about, who were operating in the 1920s. But the minute as I got into this project, which was completely on spec, me just doing it, I discovered that there was just so much more work to do. So I started going after that work. And then about halfway through, like I'm talking 3 years into it, it was just impossible. But it was one of those situations where like you decide you want to go climb, you know, K2 or something, and you're halfway up. What are you going to do? Come back down? I mean, you got to kind of keep doing it. You put yourself in that. I put myself in that situation. And fortunately, I had some really great people who helped me out putting that all together. I mean, I ended up working at the University of Michigan for a while, and I worked with a terrific editor and the final edits on the book, and a great translator and scholar, Aram Arkun, who, you know, kind of, he was my cliff notes for everything. Like what is this? And I mean, I don't know anything about history. So I didn't know anything about World War I or any of the things that you kind of have to know to understand what's going on. So but I wouldn't necessarily want to write another history book. I've been featured in a TV series where I basically go to work every week for 3 years on Law and Order CI. And I mean, it was a ton of money, which came at a great time in my life because my kids were in college at the time. But I don't know that I would want to be doing, like if they said, here's another one that's exactly like that one. And I had a blast, but I wouldn't necessarily want to do all of that again. I mean, maybe a larger role in a TV series or something, but that particular kind of role, which is this vastly overpaid job where I come in for one scene in every episode with my cup of coffee and review all the exposition of the story with the detectives, which is my only purpose on the show. The thing that was great about that, just to completely keep wandering in these topics. But what was great about Law and Order, which I did over 60 episodes of, was that I'm a stage person. I've been on stage since I was 16. And then I ended up doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these solo shows and some plays along the way and talk radio and that stuff. When it came time to be in front of a camera, which included talk radio in 1988, we shot that, I guess. The camera was always very intimidating to me. And what would happen is, they call action and all of a sudden my heart starts racing and I'm not in a zone like the zone I am on stage. On stage, I just feel completely relaxed and this is where I live. This is where I come to life. But then in front of a camera, it was different. But when I did over 60 of these Law and Orders, it kind of, it broke it for me. It broke that whole fear for me. And now, and I think I've done some of my better work in front of a camera since then, because I don't even see the camera now. It doesn't even, I don't have any feelings about it. I'm more interested in laying out the scene with the other actors.
Right. Anxiety can seem so like mystifying, you know, like, oh, I must have some issue with the camera, but on stage, when really like it might have just been you didn't have as much experience in front of the camera. And then once you said you broke through that. And I feel that way with when I struggle with intense performance anxiety with music, like I just wasn't performing enough. But then with stand up, I was performing every night, multiple times a night. I just got better at performing.
Yes.
And it wasn't this deep soul searching thing I had to figure out. It was just like, oh, I just have to practice doing this, you know.
Well, that's, and that's true for that was sort of like a theme for me through my career, because up until 1984, I used to get high a lot and drink a lot, and I would be in some situation, like I'd be in a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, drinking straight whiskey, and I have an audition the next morning, and it's like, oh, I'll get this together. It's not a problem. I'll get up at 8. I'll take a hot shower. I'll learn my lines and I'll go do it. And what I'm basically doing is I'm barely getting in there every time. And what I lose by doing that is I lose the fun of it, the enjoyment of it, which should even be in auditions. It should always be there. And as I got more, I stopped drinking, stopped drugging in 1984. And it took a little while, but eventually I started developing good habits in terms of prep. And as I prepped more and more solidly, the gig itself would be easier. And that would include particularly movies and stuff where, you know, they throw a lot of stuff at you that you didn't see coming. When you do a play, you're working around, first you block it out in a rehearsal room, then you go and you do it on set for a while, then you're in previews, and then eventually, you know, you do the thing that people know you for in that role. But in a movie, I mean, I've had situations where, like the first movie I ever did, which was special effects, I had met the actress that I was going to be doing the role with, and which involved a bed scene is the first scene in the movie, naked fucking, and then I kill her, then I strangle her to death. You can find it online, special effects. So I get to set. I've been, Andy Carlisle was the actress who was going to be playing the role. She was known for a movie called Liquid Sky. And I get to set and they inform me, no, Annie's been fired. Annie's doing something else. And you're going to be doing it with this woman, Zoe Tamerlan. So, okay, where's Zoe? I mean, we're going to start shooting in 20 minutes. And I go to find her in her dressing room and I say, hey, I'm Eric. And I know we're going to be doing this scene together. We're both going to be naked and stuff and kissing and fucking and stuff. So do you want to lay any ground rules before we begin? She says, I have no idea what you're talking about. Get the fuck out of my dressing room. So we were off to a really great start. And that's probably the worst thing that ever happened. That's my first scene ever in a movie. But all kinds of things can happen. Like the DP, you have a thing in your mind, like this is the way it's going to go. And the DP is like, oh, no, no, we're going to do it this completely other way. You're going to be hanging by your feet and we're going to light you from behind or something, whatever it is. And then there's just the natural technical stuff of all sorts of cables and, you know, can you move this way a little bit, you know, not like a radical thing, but a slight thing that you have to remember. When we did talk radio, Ellen Green, who was always very chatty on set, we had one scene that was in the flashback and it had three actions. So it was action for background, action for a secondary background, and then our action, which was causing me to really try to focus. And it was a big scene. It was hard to focus on. And Ellen says to me, as we're waiting for the first action, she goes, Eric, this movie's going to change your life. And I'm like, what the fuck? Will you stop? Why are you saying this to me right now before? I love her so much. She's just can't even. Now there's a part. I can't imagine it without her. So
what I thought about as you were speaking in terms of the filming process versus the onstage acting process is it seems like what might make filming more fun in a certain way, is that you're always trying to try different things. It's not about doing the exact same thing every time, that consistency, because why would you do it? So we already got that take. Yeah. Why would you do that again? Whereas in theater, although you do want to keep it fresh night to night, you are trying to sort of capture the same general thing every night. And those are, I mean, I guess it just depends if you like that sort of more micro variation on stage versus that, like, okay, now we're going to try something completely different and go, you know?
Well, being relaxed is definitely super good for stage or on film. And I've never been a super relaxed person. I think, you know, given what you just said, on stage, you're trying to do the best you can. So you try, you know, you're thinking, and you know, did I cross every T, dot every I? And very often after, I mean, for years, I would be in my dressing room after the show. I'd be like, oh, I totally fuck. And people are coming backstage and saying, you know, that was just great. For stage actors, 95% of what you're doing is going to be pretty much the same every night. And you have this sense of like some little thing, somebody coughed during your line or something. It just ruined the whole, I lost my, did you see me lose my concentration when that person coughed? They don't, what are you talking about? The same thing is true, but in a different way with movies. Whereas, you know, you pretty much, you throw it all out there. You can do different things. You can try to be getting it just right. Sometimes if it's a really focused scene, but the truth is they're going to be able to cut away all the bad shit and they're going to take your best performance. I've worked with actors, young actors, who literally cut themselves as they're moving their way through the scene because they can't remember the lines and they're not worried about it. They're like, well, the camera, they know how all it's going to work. It's like, oh, the camera will cut to you while I fuck up this line. So I'll just keep, right. And I haven't bothered to learn the scene. I've worked with a few people who just don't learn their scenes at all and just stumble forward through cuts. And very often audience can't see that as well. However, there is an underlying thing, and this is particularly true with two shots, where the energy of the actors, it creates an underlying, yeah, maybe you did it just right and you put your eyes just right and you said the line just right, but there's an energy, a swirl of energy in film, and like I said, particularly in two shots or three shots, where the place to look for this is in the movie Reservoir Dogs, which is almost all two and three shots. And the energy is just there all the time because you can't capture that on a master cut, which some of the big stars, you know, they like to do it that way. And then they just leave while the other person is saying their lines.
That seems insane to me because so much, and I wanted to ask you about this in terms of doing monologues too, but so much of acting is reacting. I mean, at least maybe that's an amateur thing to say. I'm not really an experienced actor, but it seems like so much of it is reacting to what the other person is giving you and that chemistry, like you were saying, and that would totally rob the process of that element.
Yeah.
But
I started with that. Obviously, I don't know whether I was as cognizant of how important it is to listen when I first started as a young, you know, high school actor. And looking back at the solos, I mean, I was actually just watching Monterey Pop the other day, and I was watching Janis Joplin and her performance, which is just incredible in that film. And she's like in some zone. I mean, granted, we can see how incredible she is and she's performing, but she's kind of inhabited by something as she's performing. And I think that in the solo stuff, that was the, I mean, not to analyze myself too much, but I guess this is all I do. I'm a, what do you call it? A narcissist. So this is all I do is think about myself. There was that quality of the solo stuff where I was kind of just wrapped up in I don't know what, some altered state in front of an audience. And that's what they're watching. So I don't know that it falls into the category of acting, but you will see those kind of things sometimes in movies as well. I mean, obviously, Joker this year, a lot of the scenes that he's in, he's just getting himself into a complete state. And that is what we're watching. But yeah, it's something you can parse forever. Like what, how does it work? What is acting? How, you know, over time, I have tried to look at the people who I admire and see what they're doing. And there is a lot of listening involved. There's a lot of, again, it's kind of hard to really define perfectly. And sometimes it's beyond me what I'm actually seeing. When Phil Hoffman did Capote and I saw that performance, and I knew him at the time, and we had worked together around that time, that performance, I have no idea what he was doing. What his eyes, everything about him was just, wow, what is he doing? I don't know what he's doing. How is this guy who's basically a jock playing Truman Capote? I don't know.
I was thinking about, monologuing versus stand-up. And when I run my jokes ahead of time just to get the wording right, I hate it. It feels like it's so much energy just to say these words with no reaction and no energy in the room. But then it comes to life when you start getting bodies in there and they're reacting, and then it's this flow. But like you said earlier, with monologuing, you don't want to lean into the laughs as much. And that's, I think, what differentiates those two art forms, even though they can kind of appear similar a lot of the time. You don't want to stray from the character, or it's not about the audience.
Well, it changes over time. I mean, my stuff started with me, as far as the solo stuff, I wasn't really listening to the audience. I wasn't looking forward to laughs or anything. I was just deep into the character, to the point where there were times when I felt like I could walk off stage and the character would still be sitting there. I mean, that's how deep it went. And over time, as I found that I could get laughs, and I knew laughs were coming, if I did a show hundreds of times, I'd know when I say this, there's going to be a laugh. Then it skewed the whole thing toward that. And I think it changed it. And I left that total being inhabited by a character thing and moving into this other thing.
Did you ever do stand up?
I did one night. One night I went, because when I started breaking out of downtown was all about loft performance and just doing crazy shit. And I was doing crazy shit, but it had an acting part to it. And then, as opposed to some visual artist who was pouring a can of paint over their head or something like that, which didn't have any acting involved. And then I started making people laugh, and there became this sort of notion that I was somehow like a comedian or something. So I went up to Catch a Rising Star, and it's funny because the material I was doing then is not unlike some material that people do today. But at the time, what year is this? 1979 or something. The character-based stuff wasn't as common. And I went out on stage, and that they have that light that is a green light, and then there's a red light, means get off the stage. I started, right, and they immediately started blinking the red light. Like, they were like, just leave, just get off the stage. And I left, and I remember going back downtown with my friend Robert Longo, the artist who was my chum at the time. And I felt like I'd been run over and mugged at the same. I never wanted to try that again, and developed a tremendous respect for stand-up comics. Also understanding that they're kind of sociopaths, and it's no wonder that they get caught doing all this fucked up shit all the time, because you have to have such a thick skin. It means that there's this interior thing going on that's just has nothing to do with the person you're presenting to the audience. I mean, I haven't studied stand-up comedy, but there are some people that the person who always intrigued me, who I met around that time because I was sort of beginning to meet, was Gilbert Gottfried. And I've never been able to get past exactly what's going on with Gilbert, because I watched his show. Somebody had taken me to see him down on McDougal Street, I guess. And afterwards, we all went out to have some coffee. And I was waiting for him to drop the persona. And he didn't drop the persona. He just stayed in that place. And I thought, wow, it must be hell to be Gilbert Gottfried, to be in that zone all the time. But maybe he was performing for me, too.
I think a lot of comedians, it might not be who they are, but they might not be comfortable being themselves even off stage. Or maybe that's just him. I don't know him. I think comedians are different. And I think I'm more like persona on stage and then myself off stage, but I think it varies with different people. But you were saying, no wonder comedians must be sociopaths. And there is something to like, we just have this like tolerance for shame, I think, in a certain way. But I think it, I think the shame is more of a cause than a symptom. Like, I think we just have shame existing, maybe, and then we're willing to just put ourselves in these other situations that might give us more shame, but it's fine because the only thing more shameful would be not to keep getting on stage. And it's just this weird cycle of shame.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you start with the thing, which I figured I found when I was 16 in high school, which is here I am, this geeky, weird kid who doesn't fit in with anything. I end up doing a play. I go out on a stage. I do the character, which was fit totally into my fantasy world that I lived in my bedroom every day, talking to myself in the mirror. And at the end, the people applauded. And that feeling of applause is incredible, especially if you've been a really marginalized weirdo kid. And now there's all these people telling you that you're great. So that was a big part of it. But the issue of shame, which you also just brought up, it's an important topic because people play with their weaknesses in front of an audience. When you look at what an actor is doing or what a stage performer, the greats in comedy are doing, there is always a level of dignity as part of it. I think if there's no dignity at all, then you're in trouble. You could get audiences to love you for being a complete shithead, but there has to be some part of it that has a dignity, which is the tragedy of Louis C.K., because as long as we believe that his insight into his own behavior makes him a greater person, then great. But then when we find out that, you know, some of the, I mean, I honestly don't even know what his thing is. I don't even understand it. There's all these guys that do these things. I don't understand why they do them. Why would anybody want to masturbate into a plant? He didn't do that. But I guess somebody else did.
I think people just have weird fetishes, and I'm not defending any of the behavior at all, but I guess I understand the idea of having a weird fetish, but you'd think you'd hide it more. I don't know. It does seem strange and unsettling, because you would think it would be in their best interest not to do that stuff too. So what is this force underneath that's like letting them do this, you know, deplorable behavior when they could probably get their needs met in some legal way? And, but you know, I guess it's the power dynamic that gets them off. But yeah, I don't know.
Why did Hugh Grant get a blowjob from Divine Brown? I mean, these are questions that will plague philosophers for centuries.
Boredom. It's boredom. Like you said before, you know, it's like, that's probably what it comes down. That's why we hear about these awful things after they've been so successful. It's like, well, you know, they've gotten all the stuff they need, maybe. And so
you want a little strange.
Yeah. They get weird. But going back to something you said about, you know, as much as I love this topic specifically, about dignity and, you know, you need to have some sort of dignity, even if you're a super dirty comic or being a total asshole on stage. There is like that fine line. I think all the jokes that get comics canceled, all that offensive stuff, it's not that I'm offended by a lot of what they're saying. I mean, maybe other people are, but for me, I'm just like, well, that's just not a funny enough joke to be able to say that. When you are more creative and thoughtful, the thing becomes less aggressive just by nature, because it is, when you're being more thoughtful and creative, you're getting more in touch with the general human experience and more people can understand it. You're bringing more people into your world. And so, I mean, it's a cowardice and not going deep enough, I think, is the real problem.
Yeah. yeah, you're playing with taboos. And there's always an element of exposure that should be kind of constructive. And if it's very funny, as you just pointed out, that is where the dignity lies, because we know that the person saying the lines created these lines, created this joke, and that gives them dignity. So whatever Richard Pryor ever talked about, or whatever Carlin ever talked about. We're also there watching them put ideas together, and we love it. My favorite bit, one of my favorite bits that my wife helped me with, is the recovering male, and he's this guy at this sort of 12-step group, and he's confessing how he feels about women, and it's ludicrous, but it kind of is about. I mean, there's a lot of confessional stuff in there, but I can put it to the ludicrous, and then it works. But there was one point, basically the guy kind of basically describes masturbating at the end of his, he's reading this letter to a girl who is a model in a bra ad, and he's confessing that he's in love with her, but he's kind of intimating that he's kind of jerking off. And, Joe was able to really push me in terms of getting the imagery as disgusting as possible by the end of that bit, which it just kind of needed. It needed that extra spice to take it. I don't ever make material that makes fun of people. And it's hard. I mean, there's so many ways to be funny. And one of the easiest ones is mocking people, you know. When I was starting out and going to LA, and occasionally I would sort of check in on comedy clubs to see what was happening there. There was a lot of comedy that was making fun of Asian people at the time. It was acceptable to make fun of Asian drivers, for example. The Comedy Store was filled with that kind of routine because nobody was saying anything about it at the time. I mean, I personally, I'll tell you, Borat, as much as I think Cohen is an incredible genius and talent, and I think particularly as an actor, the thing he did, the spy movie he did, was just fantastic. But the whole Borat thing is all resting on mocking Eastern European people. That's funny. You can't mock Asian people anymore. You certainly can't mock gay people, black people, but you can mock people of my ilk. People from the former Ottoman Empire who are from Slavic countries or the Caucasus or whatever. And you make fun of those people and everybody thinks it's just hilarious. And nobody ever says, hey, that's kind of shitting on Serbian people or Armenian people or Turkish people or whatever. And I think it's interesting that, you know, like there's a great interest in diversity among actors, and I'm a guy who doesn't look like your regular old American, and I'm ethnic. In fact, I had an agent once tell me that if I just fixed my nose and straightened my hair and changed my last name, I might have a future in this business. You know, that this whole thing does put me in a minority position, and yet there's no interest in minority representation of Armenians or all us ethnic people in movies, that nobody ever worries about whether they're hitting their quotas with Armenians.
What do you think that is? Is it just we haven't gotten there yet?
Well, we're lumped together with a group that's thought of as Semitic, and that includes Arabs, of course. Armenians are not Semitic, but Jews and Arabs are Semitic. There is an ongoing anti-Semitic tendency in our society, obviously against Jews, but also very importantly against Arabs. And it's my belief that whenever our culture, our people, America, whatever you want to call us, goes and fucks over people in another area, we always blame them for it. So like Arabs are horrible people while we steal all their oil. Back in the early 20th century, right. Mexicans are horrible people, often portrayed as lazy, who are actually the hardest working people I've ever seen in my life, as we take everything we can from Mexico and not give them anything back. And this is a thing that just comes with the territory of kind of rationalizing why it's okay to screw these people over. So unfortunately, Armenians are sort of come along for the ride in terms of a type or a personality. I know this woman who has a lovely upper crust British accent, and people are always telling her how they just love the way she sounds, you know, this Anglo, what is it called? Anglophilia or Anglo, love of Anglo is
Anglophile, yeah.
is just so present. I mean, Hugh Grant, I could listen to Hugh Grant all day long.
Oh yeah.
By the way, he's brilliant in that HBO movie that just came out.
No, I haven't seen that.
He's amazing.
I know we do. I've always thought it was unfair people who get to speak in British accents because you really can say anything. And sometimes I play this game with myself where I'm listening to a British person talk and I imagine them saying what they're saying yes. in my accent. And I'm like, okay, do I still like them or are they just an idiot?
Like and me, and you have these situations where you have classic American stories being told on American television. And when you go through all the people in the cast, 50 to 60% of them are either British or from Australia or something. And for some reason they can come here and speak in it. That's has nothing to do with what you just said, but I just wanted to throw that in there for my American friends. I mean, Abe Lincoln was played by a British guy. Okay. So that's where we're at with casting at this point, which that role was absurd, by the way. I don't care how great. I mean, I've worked with Steven Spielberg, but what was it called? Was it called Lincoln?
I guess it was called Lincoln. Yeah.
I thought the salient thing in that movie was that he really looked just like the guy on the penny. And I think the whole time you're watching the movie, you're like, he looks just like the penny. It's incredible. What great acting.
I mean, that's the thing about at least film acting is so much of it is about appearances, and we don't want to admit that, but it is, whether it's attractiveness or accuracy if we're depicting historical events. And it's what makes it so disheartening, I think, to be an actor a lot of times, is because it's not about the craft, it's about something so simple and dumb. But then it's like, well, I like looking at pretty people too, so I get it. And it's
pretty people, it's a weird thing, who you can see up close. You could never really, you know, stare at if you saw Angelina Jolie or somebody looked like her on the street. Wait, she looks kind of weird now, but I mean, you wouldn't go up to her and just like stare at her. But when you're watching a movie, you can really stare at her. But there's I think some of the actors, some of the best actors I've known, have a problem in that they don't fit into any type. Like I fit into a particular type of the talkative, deep-voiced, lawyerish, Jewish type of guy. And that's the kind of role I almost always play. Or you're incredibly great-looking, like incredibly great-looking, so that people just can't take their eyes off of you. Or you're a big, giant, fat person, or you're a super skinny, weird-looking person. I was just watching Steve Buscemi on Con Air, a great movie, the other day. And Steve, you know, came from the Lower East Side. He was a fireman, and he started doing all these different little parts in movies. Then he ended up in Reservoir Dogs, and he became a huge, huge star. And he never fixed his teeth, because those teeth, man, without those teeth, his teeth are very important to his character. Also, he happens to be a terrific actor.
You kind of have to lean into whatever there isn't really room for like I guess there are actors who are known for their diverse
roles. I mean,
and they're sort of maybe more like a method.
Philip Hoffman for one thing, Alfred Molina. There's a lot of people who, you know, really shapeshift. Sometimes actors get stuck in that they're a really good actor, but they're so damn good looking that they can't break out of the good looking part. So Richard Gere or Ethan Hawke, they look great, but they're also pretty serious actors and they always want to be taking on the serious roles, understandably.
It's so hard to be a hot person, you know?
So
it's
hard. Just... Believe me, I know.
It's just really,
I know.
We would know, but you know, heart goes out. Well, Eric, it's been so wonderful having you on the podcast.
Two hot people hanging around, just talking.
Just that'll be the title of this episode. Two hotties shooting the shit.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. For more, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, both at @IsabelHagen_, and sign up for my mailing list at isabelhagen.com. And as always, please rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much, and take care.